Today's program has been brought to you by Underground Meats, an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. For more information, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Everybody, welcome back to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Emily Peterson. This is episode number four, and this is episode number five. We just decided that. See, I am honored that you are listening to me on this here heritageradionetwork.org, broadcasting live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This week, I will answer your listener questions about knives, cheap or inexpensive wine, as we prefer to say, and music for a dinner party. First, though, my weekly rant, and what I really want to discuss with you and dissect is this government shutdown that we're in the middle of, or at least tell you why I think that simple analogies about how to fix the problem are really dangerous. I just read on the Atlantic Wire on my subway ride over here that there's a massive outbreak of salmonella. And like seven paragraphs later, it says, there isn't actually any correlation. But what is happening is this weekend, my camping trip at the National Park on Sandy Hook, New Jersey, is going to be canceled because these fine elected members of our shared democracy are being total asshats. But I can't talk about that with you because a bigger question of me was asked this weekend. Someone asked, how do I start a food blog? And the easy answer is you go to WordPress, you register a clever name, write your first post, write a recipe, put up a recipe, review a restaurant, and voila, you are a food blogger. Unfortunately, this is a very unsatisfying answer for me to give, and I should preface this by saying when I told my husband what I was going to talk about today, he said, it sounds kind of cranky. And I guess that's a little bit true, but I'm going to give you my food blog story anyway. Because asking me how to start a food blog is kind of like asking, like, how do I discover the next Twitter? Or how do I create the next Facebook? Or underneath that, what can I build for very little investment that seems really easy because I'm smart and funny and clever and I write good recipes? And then I can turn around and sell it for a massive amount of money in the form of like a cookbook. And that, my friends, is the American dream. All right, well, let's see. This has been my experience. A couple of years ago, well, it wasn't that long ago. It was probably about a year ago. I was approached by a smallish company, and they asked me to teach classes that they would market, and I could charge whatever I wanted for the class. I could basically teach whatever I want. I could do all the legwork. I'd find all the space, the kitchen, the pots, the pans, the knives, cutting boards. I would find all the ingredients, etc., and I would keep half of whatever I wanted to charge. So if I wanted to charge $500 a person, that was no problem, and they would do all the marketing and sell the classes. They reasoned, this is great. They did all the promotion. I got the money. Perfect. I reasoned, but what about like a certified kitchen? What if someone cuts their finger off? What if someone burns themselves? What if someone burns down the apartment that someone has graciously given me to, you know, use to teach for the night? And I asked what the other chef instructors were doing, and they said, well, I don't think they're really worrying about it, which I decided was not something I was comfortable with. And I was like, yeah, no thanks. But I still get their weekly emails imploring me to sign up for the next tour of a Bialy kitchen or whatever. And then one day, sold to Groupon for an undisclosed amount of money. And I got it in an email and I was like, man, not that I think I'd have seen any money from that sale. But nonetheless, the simple idea, like, do all the marketing, set up an email subscription list. And the worst part was that I was encouraged to do marketing myself. They were telling me like, well, you just tweet it to like your followers and then they'll sign up to take your class. I'm like, well, then I'm also doing the marketing. But for the person who had the simple idea, created the mailing list, boom, retirement on a white sandy beach. I don't know. Who knows? I don't know what they were sold to Groupon for. And the truth is that it's mostly rooted in jealousy. But anyway, I'm excited for them. Can't you tell? And back to food blogging. While there are some very successful food bloggers out there, and many, or maybe just some of whom have parlayed their readership into a cookbook deal or a TV show like The Pioneer Woman or Smitten Kitchen or Hungry Girl, the reality is I think that that phenomenon had a very short window And I think maybe that window has closed, or at least is very close to being closed. If you use Google and search for a recipe, every single search result that comes back now is for a food blog. Like, I just searched for raw peanut butter chocolate cookies because I have a personal chef client that likes to eat healthy. And every single result, well, you know, I didn't look at all 1.68 million, but the first two pages, they were all from food blogs. And that's great, and it's easy, and it's simple. And sometimes it's even my very own retired food blog that's above the fold. It just doesn't translate the way that this person who asked me looked at me like, oh, how do I start a food blog? Like, it just hasn't translated for me anyway into like my ties on a vacation in Phuket. And for the other masses of people who are putting up their recipes, it, you know, because they're like creating cake pops or something cute and they're taking beautiful food porn pictures. Like, I don't think the majority of those people are actually living this glamorous life that a lot of media and my, you know, I can also be guilty of this, have led other people to believe food bloggers are living. I started my blog in 2008, and it was more like a lifeline to the world that I wanted to be part of because other food bloggers had made it look so romantic and so cool, and like they get paid to write about food. I hadn't gone to culinary school yet, and I hated my job, and I was like, I'll start a food blog. And I have an undergraduate degree in design, which meant that I know how to use Photoshop and a little bit of HTML. And so it was like a place that I could archive my recipes and like review some restaurants. My first restaurant review was of Aquavit, and it was really fun and like three paragraphs long. And I truly didn't tell anybody this, but in the back of my mind, I really thought eventually I would be able to cash in on this. And I totally did. Emotionally, I haven't seen a dollar in reality. I mean, it got me encouraged enough to go to culinary school. And so I was, you know, by doing this writing practice every day, I was slowly building up my confidence and realizing that I could, in fact, write about food and that I could write successful recipes and that it was a discipline that I looked forward to doing every couple of days. And just a word about the successful recipes part. When you get a recipe out of a cookbook, particularly one that's published by a reputable publisher, of which there are several, many even, the recipes have been tested. When you get a recipe off of a food blog, you're relying on that food writer to have tested their recipe and not have made any typos. And while I often tell people, like, I don't know, you cook it, like, how long do I cook this for? I don't know, you cook it till it's done. In the written form, that doesn't really translate so easily. But so I was writing my food blog and I got to culinary school and I did get some work out of my food writing because it was there as this archive of years of my time in writing. But I got that work after I'd gone to culinary school and after I had the degree to back it up. I even got to be on NBC a couple of times and on Martha Stewart and a bunch of other fancy places, and they were all for free. I didn't get paid anything. And it was with this promise of exposure, which is in quotation marks, which if you know anything about making money on the internet, numbers of visitors translate into dollars in advertising. That's, it's, you know, like anything else. An advertiser wants to know, how many people am I going to reach? And you sell them, well, 5 people look at my blog today, or 50,000 people looked at my blog today. That's going to define how much advertising dollar somebody wants to give you. But here's the thing. Even with that exposure on a national platform, no one cared. I don't think my brother reads my blog. Or ever did. I don't think he's listening right now. Not that I don't think that, you know, not that people haven't like searched for my homemade dog cookies recipes, which is what I cooked on NBC, and they find my website. But think about it. When was the last time you were watching like Good Morning America or The Chat or The Chew, whatever the Mario Batali show is, or the one with the chick from Big Bang Theory and Roseanne? The Talk, right? Yeah, The Talk. Like, when was the last time you were watching that and it was on your screen in the living room while you were vacuuming and you jumped onto your computer to find out about the chef that was sitting there making crepes? And most of the time, the hosts talk over the cooks anyway, right? Me? Never. Not one time. Until yesterday, because I'm the mother of a 1-year-old and I watch a lot of daytime TV, I happened to catch the end. This chef's talking about making Thai iced tea. And I had just gone out for Thai food with friends. And I was like, I want to make Thai iced tea at home. Like, what makes Thai iced tea so delicious? So I did. I jumped online and I looked at their website. And it's 1 tablespoon Thai iced tea mix. add milk. And I was like, really? So, a friend of mine who does celebrity chef PR gave me a piece of advice a few years ago when I was still believing that my food blog was going to, you know, take off into this massive career. And what she said, I'll pass this piece of advice along, which is Al Roker doesn't hold up websites. Al Roker holds up books. Now, it's a better way to get a cookbook published if you have a platform and you have some readers that you can, you know, tell your agent to tell a publisher that they're probably going to buy your book if you publish it for the writer. But if your goal is to start a food blog because Rachel Ray is getting a little long in the tooth, or because Paula Deen's sponsors have an opening in their marketing budgets, by all means, I wish you the absolute best of luck. And who knows, maybe Scripps Network will call, or some other really big advertiser, maybe Audible will call. But in reality, do it because you love to do it. Do it because you would write all of that stuff knowing, even if knowing, no one's ever going to read it. I don't know if you are familiar with Drunk Kitchen, but the whole joke, aside from that she's drunk and adorable and I think she's really funny, she never reads any of the stories. It's all about scrolling down to get to the recipe. So it becomes a place for you to have a searchable archive of all of your own recipes and keep your own recipe collection, which I didn't realize going into it, but it's actually really easy. When I want to find my chili recipe, I go to my own blog and type in chili. And it's fun. And you become a better writer and you'll become a better photographer and someone might actually like it and read it. But back to the easy answer, you do have to build it first, right? So you go to WordPress and you register a clever name and make it memorable, which is getting harder and harder to do because there are lots and lots of taken clever names. Better yet, you can go to Bluehost and get your very own domain and start writing because you love to write about food and because you love to write about recipes. If you want to be the next Food Network celebrity, I suggest getting a headshot and an agent. That being said, I'll plug my old blog, which I no longer write on. It's The Gourmand and the Peasant. Your questions after the break.
You're listening to Like You Mean It by the California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Now let me tell you a story about a young man and his lady friend. The poor boy couldn't make...
Underground Meats is an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. They use small farms from southwest Wisconsin to source their meat. The animals are raised on pasture for their entire lives by farmers who care about animal welfare. While Underground Meats uses European traditions, they also use ingredients from the upper Midwest to try to create new types of salamis, experimenting with both ingredients and techniques. The salamis are made using heritage breeds, mostly red wattles, tamworths, berkshires, and mule foots. Try their award-winning cured pork shoulder and goat salami. To learn more and purchase products, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin.
Was that too cranky? I don't think that was too cranky. I'm just trying to be realistic. I'm just trying to say, here's the reality of the situation. I don't know. Whatever. I'd love to hear what you think. I'd love to hear if you think that was totally, totally depressing. I don't think so. I think encouraging you to do something because you love it is the opposite of cranky. Okay, so every week I answer your listener questions, and I was out in the wild this week and several people asked me, oh, that's such a great idea for a show. I have a question. I think everybody's got questions. What you got to do to get your voice on the air is call 862-242-8599 and leave the question on the designated voice mailbox, and I will give you a thoughtful answer. You can also tweet me at Chef Emily P. Visit sharpandhot.com or facebook.com/sharpandhot and leave your questions there as well. Although chances are strong, I'll probably reach out to you and ask you to record it anyway because it's more fun to hear your own voice on the radio. I mean, if you're, you know, a total narcissist like me, which is why I have a radio show. Okay, question number one is from Dana in Randolph.
Hi, Chef Emily. This is Dana from Randolph, New Jersey. And my question is that I am wondering, where do you get great knives? And which knives do you really need in your home kitchen? Thanks.
This is a question that I get asked all the time. And there are few things in the world that I collect. And in fact, it came up this weekend that I actually throw out a lot of things. Things that I will later go back looking for, and I'll say, where was that little saucepan that we used to have? And my husband will say, you threw it out. And I'll say, no way! I didn't throw it out, and then I'll like continue looking for it, and then like reality and memory starts to creep in. I'm like, oh yeah, I do vaguely remember that pot sitting, like not, me not liking how it sat on the stove just right, and selling it at a garage sale for 50 cents. So, that being said, one of the few things that I do collect are knives, and I have a large collection. Between my husband and I, we have a large collection together. I think it's a project that people who love to cook work on over their entire lifetime. I have found some super cool, old, obscure butchering and hunting knives at flea markets that no one knows what they are. You take them to a knife person or you sharpen them yourself and you get them cleaned up and oiled and they look beautiful. I find them at flea markets. I find them at yard sales. I find them at like driving around in Vermont and I drive by a barn that's only open on the third Thursday of the month and we just happen to be driving by on the right day. And at the bottom of a box, dull, is a knife that is actually beautiful and elegant. That being said, if you are starting fresh or starting from scratch, there are some basic knives that every home cook should have in their collection. With the exception of a bread knife, which I'll talk about in a second, your knife should be on the expensive side. If it's cheap, there's a reason for that. And knives are something that you're going to keep your whole life, and you're going to get to know, and you're going to get to have favorites for particular tasks. So knife number one that everyone should have is a 10-inch chef's knife. And it should cost about $100. It doesn't really matter what brand. If you have Wusthof or whatever, it doesn't really make all that much difference. It should be something that's comfortable in your hand. So I would recommend going to a store where they allow you to handle the knives before you purchase one, as opposed to buying it on Amazon or Williams-Sonoma's website or whatever. There are knives where... Well, any knife that you get should be full tang, meaning that the metal that makes up the blade, that's sharpened into the blade, also goes all the way down into the handle and is affixed to the handle. There is a brand of knives where the handle itself is part of the metal, and it has like little holes in it. It looks like a little aerated handle. Some people love those. I don't particularly like how that feels in my hand. I like having the polished wood handle, but I want to be able to see that the blade of the knife goes all the way through the handle. If it's not a full tang knife, it means that the metal of the blade is affixed usually to the plastic handle by some sort of adhesive, which after washing and washing and washing it, it's going to fall apart at some point. And you don't want it to be falling apart while you're carving your Thanksgiving turkey or something else important is happening. So you find this 10-inch long chef's knife. When you go into a store where they are selling them, the person doing the sales will let you hold all of them. And you'll just get used to, I mean, it would be great if they actually had a cutting board and like an onion for you to practice on. But you'll get used to the weight. There are some double thick bladed knives, the way that the handle feels in your hand. But I recommend 10 inches. And for home cooks, that at first will feel really, really big. But it's going to be your go-to knife that you're going to take really good care of. If you are cutting, chopping, slicing, mincing, dicing, anything, this is going to be the knife that you reach for. Even little things like chives and shallots. You would still use your big chef's knife, which is why it takes some getting, you know, finding the knife that you love and getting used to it and getting acquainted with it. It's still the knife that you're going to use. Which brings me to the paring knife. A paring knife is something that everyone should have, but it is not a miniature chef's knife. It shouldn't be used for just chopping smaller things. You use your paring knife, which has a blade that's about the width of your palm, so it's like 3 or 4 inches long. It should cost about $40 to $50. It should also be full tang. And this is, you use it for all of the tasks that require the thing that you're cutting to be held in your hand, like peeling an apple or peeling a potato. So you're holding something in your non-dominant hand. For me, that's my left hand. And in my dominant hand, because I'm a righty, I hold my paring knife and I peel or turn the vegetable, whatever it is that I'm... If I'm peeling the potato, I'm using my left hand to turn it and my paring knife to peel the potato. I'm not using my paring knife then to dice that potato. I would switch to my 10-inch chef's knife. A bread knife, I mentioned, is something that you can have that's inexpensive. Because you use it so infrequently, it doesn't get washed, and so it's not being exposed to warm water and soap every day like your more high-frequency knives are. And so it doesn't. I think mine was $3 at IKEA, and I've had it for 10 years. It's perfect for slicing bread, but it's also the ideal knife for slicing tomatoes, which is a little chef secret that not a lot of people know. So bread knife, chef's knife, paring knife, those are the three required knives. If you want to get a little fancy, a boning knife is good if you want to French your own lamb chops or make chicken drumsticks and chicken lollipops, which is all over the menus in my neck of the woods out by the farm in New Jersey. But to French something means that you use the curve. There's an inner curve on a boning knife, and you use that to scrape all of the flesh away from the bone on the rack of lamb ribs or on the chicken drumstick. And when you cook it, it looks fancy. That's the reason. And then I also have a flexible fillet knife that I take surf casting with me on the off chance that we'll catch a striped bass or a bluefish and I'll get to fillet it right on the beach. But so far that hasn't happened, but I will be ready when it does.
Hi, Emily. This is Brad from New York. I am calling to ask about wine. I like to, entertain people, have people over, that kind of stuff. But there is a limit to how much I can spend on entertaining folks. So I want to serve people something that's good, but isn't going to ruin me. I was wondering if you had any recommendations. Any help you could give me would be great. Thank you so much.
I have found so many inexpensive wines that now I have a hard time coughing up more than $10 or $11 for a bottle of weeknight wine, even weekend wine. Here's the key. It's not about the label that's on the wine. It's about learning some simple sort of wine rules. Then you can figure out how to find good, inexpensive wines in your local wine store. So rule number one, and this is, anytime I say this rule, everybody's like, oh, I've never heard of that before. This should be the first thing you do when you pick up any bottle of wine is you turn it over and you look at the alcohol level. You want low alcohol, but not too low. So what does that mean? In a red wine, you want an alcohol content of like 12.5% or 13%. And you can find lots of inexpensive red wine, but they will have like 14 or 15% alcohol, which translates into tasting like whiskey and setting your mouth on fire, particularly if you're eating any food, eating a food that has any heat to it at all, and also feeling not so hot the next day. So 14 or 15% of alcohol is way, way too high. Maybe 14 if it's from a cold climate, like northern France, but you just almost never find them. They're usually the ones from like, Australia or something like that, California. So red wine, 12.5%, 13%. In white wine, 11 or 12% alcohol is perfect. Less than that, and you end up getting into sweet wines, which are awesome with spicy food, which is a whole other show altogether. I'll just say as a side note, in German wines, the lower the alcohol, the sweeter the wine. In German wines in particular, Rieslings in particular, you can tell how sweet a Riesling is going to be based on the alcohol content. So if you have like an 8 or a 9 or a 10% alcohol wine, that's going to have some sugar left in it from the fermentation process, which is delicious if that's what you're in the mood for. But if you want more of a cocktail wine, if you are someone who enjoys drinking Sauvignon Blanc, 11 or 12%. So what that basically means is skip California. Actually, for this purpose, you can probably skip the New World altogether, which the New World means Australia, New Zealand, and the United States. Although, truthfully, 90% of those wines are going to be knocked out by the alcohol rule anyway. So if you're looking for something under $10, you're probably not going to be able to find a wine that is $10 from Australia and also has low alcohol. You can find Yellowtail. Another good rule of thumb is any wine that can afford advertising probably isn't worth the money to drink it. You want to find things that are coming from smaller producers. So I'm going through these rules kind of. I've literally been working in the wine world. One of my first jobs in the wine industry was wrapping Christmas presents when I was 14 in my family friend's wine store. And so I've been surrounded by this for a long time. So I'm trying to distill it just for the purposes of guessed something delicious without breaking the bank for you. Steer clear of anything that's got a cute name like cupcake or barefoot or any of that. These are not going to be things that are delicious. So in the old world, which is France, Italy, Germany, Austria, inexpensive wines are produced because lots of people drink it there. And there's not a stigma that's like similarly attached here where it's like, oh, I have to spend like $25, $35, $45 on a bottle of wine, when the truth is everybody's only going to really taste the first couple of sips, and then they're going to be having a conversation and the alcohol's going to start setting in anyway. In my everyday wine bin, I have something called a Mediterranean blend that is from Spain, and it is $5.99 a bottle, and it is delicious. It has no oak, it's stainless steel, and I would venture to guess there's some Pinot Grigio, some Pinot Gris. I don't really care. And I don't think it's consistent because they're taking the grapes that, they're buying grapes on the commodity market and they're making a wine that is cheap, inexpensive, drinkable, delicious. And I have poured it for wine drinking friends who are like, yeah, $13, $14, $12, $13 a bottle. Nope, it's $6 and it's delicious. So I bet there are some wine friends of mine who are like, what? I'm not kidding. Try it. For red wine, I always look to Cote de Rhone. My wine friend and I were talking this morning, Kimberly Severson, who owns a catering company in New Jersey called Spoon and Cork, which I just think is an adorable name. We were talking today about Cote de Rhone, and I asked her why it was that there seemed to be so many more affordable Cote de Rhone as opposed to like affordable Bordeaux, where we're in like the $45 range. And she said that the climate in Cote de Rhone is perfect for producing grapes, which means that there's a lot more supply and a lot more yield, and that translates into more wine, which means lower cost. It also doesn't have quite the same like cachet in saying, oh, it's a Bordeaux. You can find delicious like Valpolicellas from Italy for less than $12. And the best way to find out what wine you like and which wine is good is to buy a couple of bottles of wine. And when we're talking about inexpensive wine, that shouldn't be hard to do. Buy two or three or four different whites, two or three or four different reds, open them at the same time and taste them next to each other. It's extra fun if you're doing a dinner party. And speaking of a dinner party and you're having friends over to entertain them, if you're worried about a snob like me is going to come and be like, oh, I know how much that bottle of wine was. I'm going to recognize your $8.99 bottle. Even worse, it's when it's on restaurant menus. I'm like, I know how much that bottle of wine is. Just pour it into a cheap decanter or one that you pick up at a barn sale or like a cute carafe that you get at Williams-Sonoma for like $5. And then no one knows what the label is and just say, oh yeah, I don't know. It's just this old Bordeaux I've had laying around. And the truth is it doesn't really matter. Okay. Last question for this week.
Hi, Emily. This is Emily from Petoskey, Michigan. And I'm wondering if you've got suggestions for a dinner playlist. Thanks. Bye. Hi, Emily.
Oh, see, that's me messing with the technology. So for my 30th birthday, my husband made me a birthday party playlist, which followed the natural arc of how a party goes. And so he put it together so that while people were arriving, there was a lot of like popular music that year, like the Sock Hop. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not that old. Oh, I can't even believe I made that joke. God, I'm not going to make that joke again. That really sounds terrible. It was like Flaming Lips, some Grizzly Bear. It was laid back, but like poppy and recognizable so that, you know, when early guests were coming, they had something to kind of like, oh yeah, I recognize this music even before there's people to talk to. And then he figured as people started talking and mingling, he transitioned to some jazz and songs without lyrics. And then like as people started to like drink and relax and the party got going a little bit more, he put on some like retro music from when we were in high school. I believe there was like Jump Around and some Crisscross on it. And then as the party wound down, so too did the music, and he put on like Julie London and some REM, and it was perfect. And I still listen to it and it makes me so happy. I've been told that I need to figure out how to use Spotify. So maybe I'll try to figure out a Spotify playlist if someone can explain to me how that works. And then you can listen to it for yourself. So last week I asked you for what your favorite food was of all time. And, we got this answer from Sarah.
This is Sarah from Bedford, Massachusetts. And the best thing that I've ever eaten is the first time I had authentic French butter. So fat, creamy, and rich. My jaw dropped. Best thing on the planet.
Mine was when I went to Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago, and Jose Andreas closed his restaurant mini bar, and in the space opened in collaboration with the National Archives a pop-up restaurant called America Eats, which was a menu tour of the history of the United States of America, and dating back to the, I guess, 1600s, and everything had its had a very contemporary twist on it. I had abalone for the first time, which is a West Coast seafood shellfish that's very hard to harvest and hard to grow, and it was absolutely phenomenal. It was just like rich and briny and sweet, and it came with a foam, which is not something that I usually enjoy, but it was like butter, and oh, it was just so good. And I actually got to meet Jose Andreas at a party that I accidentally crashed a couple of weeks ago because I showed up to an interview on the wrong day, and it was his release party for this new product blend that he's launching. And I tried to tell him that story, and he was like, just shut up and take the picture with the camera in front of you. And I was like, okay, never mind. So I need you to call me and tell me your questions so that I can answer them on the air. The phone number is 862-242-8599. You can tweet me at Chef Emily P. Find me on Facebook at facebook.com/sharpandhot. sharpandhot.com. You are listening to me on heritageradionetwork.org. And this has been wonderful yet again. I'm so honored to have your ear, and I will talk to you again next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.